All right, here we go, 6:14 on this Wednesday morning, January 14th. Almost done with the first month of 2026 already. Slight chance for showers. Whatever is left will be gone by around 8 o'clock. Highs of 64 today. Then I heard Peyton Malone earlier maybe say, get out the big heavy coat, which I like. Not because I'm necessarily a fan of the cold weather, but by golly, I bought a big heavy coat and I want to use it. At least occasionally. 51 for a high tomorrow. Plenty of wind as well. Highs of 66 Friday. Then looking at the weekend, nice highs in the 50s and plenty of sunshine. So get out and enjoy that. Ted Russ, did I tell you right now it's about 49 degrees? Well, if not, I'll just tell you that right now. It's about 49 degrees. Ted Rossman joins us now, our friend. He is a financial Bankrate senior industry analyst. Good morning, Ted. How are you?
Good morning. Doing well. Thank you.
Let's talk about what President Trump is talking about with credit card interest rates.
Yes, he's talking about a one-year 10% cap, which would be a pretty dramatic reduction. Right now, the average credit card charges around 20%. Many people are actually paying 25%, 30%, sometimes even more. The highest credit card rates I see are around 36%. This is a big deal because millions of Americans have credit card debt. Roughly half of cardholders carry debt from month to month. Six out of every 10 with debt have had it at least a year. So it's a big pain point for people. I just worry that the 10% cap is so low that banks would react very negatively. They say they would cut back on access to credit, and that may actually have huge unintended consequences that could actually hurt a lot of the people who this is intended to protect.
So what would that look like, banks reacting and cutting back on credit?
The Electronic Payments Coalition and the Missouri Bankers Association did a study, and they estimated that about 90% of credit card holders could actually lose access to credit if a 10% cap were enacted. And that's really because of the risk assessment. Credit card debt is unsecured. It's not backed by a home or car or any other underlying asset. So banks' big worry is that people are not going to pay them back. And they say that 10% is just not a workable cap for them. They need to charge more than that to account for delinquencies and defaults and other overhead. So they say the reaction would be to just pull back on lending. And a lot of people just wouldn't be able to use credit cards anymore. Now, that seems like kind of an extreme reaction, but it just shows how far apart the two sides are on this issue. A 10% cap would be really, really low, considering that the current average is about double that. It's very hard to find a credit card rate in the single digits. There are 0% balance transfer promotions, of course. Those last up to a couple of years. But on an ongoing basis, I can think of very few credit cards below 10%. A handful of credit unions offer those to people with really good credit. But a lot of mainstream cards are more like 20 to 25%.
Did he say what the stated goal of this would be to lower it for 1 year to 10%?
It's really an affordability issue. It's part of this whole midterm campaign to make things more affordable, kind of like other proposals that we've seen recently about housing and other aspects of our finances. The 1 year part is interesting. Maybe that's an acknowledgement that one realizes this can't last forever, or maybe it's somehow to make it more palatable to regulators or the courts. My understanding is that this is not something that can be done by executive order, that it would require congressional approval. Now, interestingly, there are a bipartisan group of senators who would love to see this happen, including some like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who rarely agree with the president on policy proposals. You also have some Republicans like Senator Marshall from Kansas and Senator Hawley from Missouri who are behind this. So there is actually interesting bipartisan agreement. It seems, though, that it's one of those things that sounds better in theory than it would play out in the real world.
I got so many questions about this. First of all, how did it get to be legal to charge somebody 36% interest? I know, Nooney Noneck's been doing that for a long, long time. But when it comes to like credit cards and codified law, et cetera, is this the state or the federal government that regulates this?
Yeah, it's a good question. There is no federal cap on credit card rates for most people. There's a Military Lending Act that has a 36% cap for service members, and that's kind of become the unofficial ceiling for everybody. Even the highest rate cards for people with lower credit scores or store credit cards, those have very high rates. A lot of those top out around 36%. There was a 1978 Supreme Court case that declared that it matters where the bank is based, not the customer, with respect to state interest rate caps and usury laws. So really what that did was it incentivized banks to set up shop in states that either don't have a cap or have a very high cap. So if the bank is based in South Dakota or Delaware or Utah, these are some places that either have high caps or no cap, they can basically export that everywhere. So even if your state has a lower cap, if the bank is based in, say, South Dakota, they can charge essentially whatever they want or up to that state's cap, which is really, really high, or non-existent. So that really incentivized a lot of banks to go to places like South Dakota.
I get the midterm campaign aspect of this, the political aspects of this. The financial part of this makes no sense to me, and I'll explain why when we come back. And you can tell me, Ted, if I'm on to anything or not. Ted Rossman, our guest, Bankrate senior industry analyst. The president wants to cap interest rates on credit cards at 10% for, correct me if I'm wrong, Ted, 1 year, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Which just raises a lot of questions on my part. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back, 620, traffic now, WWL. Thank you, Joseph. We'll talk to you in a little bit. Ted Rossman rejoins us, Bankrate senior industry analyst. So here's the thing about President Trump wanting to reduce the interest rates on credit cards for 1 year only to 10%. I get the political part of that. But really, it goes the philosophy of credit cards. If you're going to use a credit card, a bank card, for a long-term loan, you're making a big mistake because you're going to find a better rate. If you need a loan, go get a loan. Now, I understand some people can't, and as a result, that makes them higher credit risks. So, therefore, the higher credit interest rate. I understand that. I get all of that. But the one-year thing, I don't get that at all, because that's not going to really incentivize people to pay it off because the interest rate is lower for 1 year, is it? I'm missing something here, or am I, Ted?
A one-year pause could give you a big upper hand on knocking down your debt, but you could actually already do that by signing up for a 0% balance transfer card. Mm-hmm. So you take your existing high-cost debt, you move it over to a card that in some cases won't charge interest for 2 years. So that's actually a better deal that's already out there. Now, it's a little different because you have to apply. Not everybody gets approved. But if you have good credit, and most people are in the right ballpark, you could sign up for the U.S. Bank Shield Visa, get 2 years interest-free, or the Citi Simplicity is 21 months. Wells Fargo Reflect is also 21 months. These balance transfer cards are a pretty amazing deal because if you have the average balance, which is around $6,500, you could pay less than $300 a month to be interest-free within 2 years, debt-free within 2 years. That's an amazing tailwind. So that would be my advice. Take matters into your own hands. Make your personal credit card rate zero. I just think the government price control angle could really backfire and lead to a lot less access to credit. But paying down your own debt is a really smart idea.
And I guess the other problem I have is that it seems as though, if anything, this would incentivize people to, well, hey, it's 10%. That's not bad, to run up a big credit card balance, and then it's not 10% anymore. Then they really find themselves in a hole.
That is a worry, yeah. I mean, definitely you want to use credit cards to your advantage. I do worry, though, that a 10% cap would lead to less access to credit. So if banks stop lending, are people going to turn to payday loans, or how are they going to afford daily life? A lot of people put practical things on credit cards, like groceries and car repairs.
It's kind of like being treated, this is going to sound terrible, for an STD. It's a little late after, by that time. It seems like the idea before that is to prevent anything from happening in the first place. I apologize for that analogy, Ted, but it's the best I could come up with traffic coming up and news and everything else. You have a great day, my friend.
All right, thank you. Have a good one.
You bet. Ted Rossman, Bankrate senior industry analyst. We'll take a break. We come back, we'll talk to David Schultz, a professor of political science at Hamline University, about independence. Are you actually independent or not? Because a lot of people say they are, but when it comes time to vote, goes back to the R or the D. And also, I'll ask him about President Trump. Has he changed politicking forever? Right now, 6:30, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Eno's Inn. 6:46, 14 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. New Gallup poll out about people identifying as independent or Republican or Democrat. David Schultz is here to help us break it down. He's our friend, a professor of political science at Hamline University. How are you, David?
I'm doing well. I hope you're doing well so far this year.
I am, sir. Oh, Happy New Year, I guess I should tell you. It's January 14th. It's going to turn a little bit cold here. High right now, it's 49 degrees. What are we looking at in Minnesota, just out of curiosity?
Okay, right now it is going to 16 degrees, which is going to be roughly our high for today, and I think it's going down to just about zero. Now, we had a heat wave the last 2 days. We were up to almost 40 degrees. So whenever we get cold, really cold weather, it eventually reaches you. Now, when I used to live in Texas, we used to call that a blue northerner coming in. I'm not sure what term you use. Our really super cold weather eventually trickles down to you a little bit.
I believe here we say it's going to turn cold, brah.
Okay.
That's
okay.
What saying, yeah. So look, let me ask you this. I know you're in Minneapolis, right?
I'm in St. Paul. I'm right across the river. I'm literally a mile from Minneapolis.
And yes. I know that the area where the ICE incident took place is pretty close to proximity-wise to where the George Floyd incident took place. And since we're talking about the weather, let's talk about the political climate, if you will, the civil climate in Minnesota right now. What are you sensing, comparing and contrasting this to the George Floyd incident?
If I were to use the words tense and anxious, I think that's absolutely correct, because what everybody's worried about here is that, you know, after George Floyd was murdered, and we can say he was murdered because he was convicted by a jury. So, you know, we could actually say, you know, and Chauvin murdered him, is that, you know, we know, as you saw in the news, the riots broke out. We had a lot of really bad stuff happen here. And everybody has been kind of like holding their breath, like, please, please, let's just not have a repeat of what happened, you know, against, you know, almost 6 years ago. And so there's for most of the people who are coming out, peaceful protesting, which is, of course, protected under the First Amendment, it's peaceful. But they're like, in any group, there's a bunch of yahoos out there. So like overnight, there were some protests last night and some property got damaged. And so it's, you know, I always call it the 98-2 rule. 98% of us are, you know, are law-abiding, decent, trying to do our job, and 2% are jerks. And that's what we're all worried about, that 2%. And then also with it is that neither the Trump administration nor our local politicians are doing anything to de-escalate. You know, I mean, their rhetoric is just like feeding into things. And what we really need everybody to do is just take a pill, you know, and go to their respective corners. And so that's sort of how most of us, I think, out there are looking at things right now.
You didn't come on to talk about that, but since you're there and you're living it and you're breathing it and you're feeling it, I thought I'd get your take on it. Let's talk about this Gallup poll about people identifying as political independents. What did it show?
Okay, so if we were to go back, it's working from a Gallup poll. Let's say if we went back to roughly the year 2000, okay, about 33%, about one out of three voters would describe themselves as an independent. That is neither Democrat or Republican. But in the latest Gallup poll that just came out, I think on Monday, if I remember correctly here, it's now at a record high of 45% who say they are independents. And so over last 25 years, we've gone from 33% to 45% who identify as independents. And so that's, you know, that's a pretty big shift that's occurred over the last quarter century.
Is there a disconnect when it comes to identification and voting? Because I know for a long time, this was back in the day, not now, for a long time, I thought myself to be an independent. But when it came to voting, man, I actually went to that, defaulted to that letter every time, that R or that D. What about now?
It's still the case here is that the phrase that Gallup uses called leaners, you know, that so I might ask you, Tommy, you know, how are you? I'm an independent, you know, then you might, you know, but then, you know, ask you how you vote, and you say, well, I really vote Republican or I really vote Democrat or something like that, you know, but I consider myself X or something like that. Yeah, what we find is that of that 45% that claim to be independents, the Gallup poll is saying that 20%, of that 45%, it breaks down, 20 lean Democrat, 15 lean Republican, and about 10% are non-leaners. So if we actually filter through absolutely everything, maybe 10% of the voters are truly truly leaners at some point, you know, or maybe even less at this point. So, but we do have people who kind of break it down. So what it really looks like, if we add up all the leaners like that, and plus who identify with a party, about 47% of the U.S. population says they're Democrats or leading Democrat. About 42% are saying Republican or leading Republican. And remember, by the way, this is according to a Gallup poll. This is people self-identifying themselves, by the way, too.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back 6:51, 9 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. 6:57 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, about a poll out of Gallup poll that shows more people have identified, or more people are identifying as independent as opposed to a party affiliation. But then again, there's a big disconnect when it comes to actually voting. That's correct, David? They still vote the R or the D?
Correct. We still have very, very small percentage of the population that goes in and votes for, let's say, a third party candidate for president of the United States.
All right, let me talk about politicking, if I may, because they had an incident yesterday at a auto plant in Michigan, and I'm not calling a president out for this because you can only imagine what politicians really say about people. Oh, heck of hell, what your own family says about you when nobody's within earshot, or, you know, what are this, what are that. Somebody yelled at President Trump, so he flipped him off, supposedly. I didn't see the video. This is just from news reports. Has President Trump changed the way we politic in this country, or is that a unique Trumpian thing? Because you can't imagine the president of the United States flipping off somebody, although, you know, a lot of them have already thought it in their minds and not acted upon it. But I just wonder if it's a unique Trump thing, or if that's going to change the way, like, for example, he's kind of off the cuff when it comes to foreign policy, et cetera. Has he changed the way politics operate in America or not?
I think he has. I mean, some things are unique, but he has. But just in terms of the language, I mean, without going into without using the language on the radio, because we can't do it here, mm-hmm. Our local politician and mayor in Minneapolis basically said, you know, to ICE, you know, get the F, and I'm not going to use the word on the air, of course. So, I mean, it used to be you would never hear politicians use that kind of language publicly. So it's he's changed the discourse. He's changed the wording.
And it'd be interesting to see if that's a good thing or a bad thing, because while it does maybe lower the threshold for the way people could conduct themselves in public, maybe it lends an air of candidness or honesty to it.
Possibly it is. I mean, he's talking like what most of our listeners are talking at that point, and maybe that's a way of connecting to the voters better than they used to.
But would we really want that to be president? We'll see. Thank you, David. Appreciate the time. We'll be back. WWL. Chilly start to this Wednesday morning, but it's Wednesday, right? So we'll take that. Right now, about 50 degrees. If you average your temperatures in the area, and it's going to get colder tomorrow, whatever rain is left should be gone by middle of the day. And then it turns cold and windy. Adam Knapp joins us now, CEO for Leaders for a Better Louisiana. Good morning, Adam. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I'm doing good.
You snuck in just under the wire because I said January 15th is the cutoff for, I got taxes on my mind, can you tell? January 15th is the cutoff for Happy New Year. So Happy New Year to you, sir.
I'll take it. Thank you.
Let's talk about what's going on with jobs in Louisiana.
So we put out a little note yesterday or 2 days ago that the Louisiana that we have grown up in and known for years has always been smaller than what it is today in terms of jobs. That's pretty interesting to know that we've grown to a place where we now should be talking about Louisiana as a place that has more than 2 million jobs. And that may not mean a whole lot to folks, but it's been a mark that Louisiana hasn't been able to hit and then hang on to ever before.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about
where the state is right now.
What it means in terms of context. Put that in some kind of context about 2 million jobs.
Yeah, so there's probably about just less than half of the states have 2 million jobs. So we're in unique territory for what that means in terms of the size of the state's economy. But it's also that, you know, we got to this a decade ago, and it was, you know, kind of this elusive mark. We thought, hey, at some point we'll get to 2 million jobs. That'll feel like a high water mark and a new place to describe kind of what the state has in terms of its scale as an economy. But we got to it back in like 2014, hung on to it for like 4 months, and then it slipped away from us. And we haven't seen it for a decade. It feels like, you know, a sports season, you know, that kind of, you have a great moment and then it gets gone. And so the where we are today, it's interesting. We crossed this mark mid-year last year. And so a lot of folks just started watching to see if we'd hang on to it. And so we looked at this just last week when the latest numbers came out for what was November last year. And the state has now hung on to this point for 7 months. And it looks like the state's in a growth position that it's likely to stay in that position well into the new year. And so this feels like it's something we all need to kind of take a note of and just say this is the new normal as a state with 2 million jobs.
So to keep the sports analogy going, what are some of the factors that lead to the 2 million jobs? And also, what is it that that can lead to the loss of those or that not being accomplished? And I guess what I'm trying to ask you, what are the factors and what are you competing against?
Well, I think the state has really kind of redoubled its efforts to try to grow its economy. You've seen a much more aggressive team and effort from Louisiana Economic Development, from every regional organization. You know, New Orleans is blessed with a great regional effort and great local efforts across the metro area. But that is, you know, now pretty standard across the entire state that almost every metro area has a really aggressive regional and local team that's pushing for new investment. And the state is doing the same. And I think what we've seen is a pretty sizable increase last year in the total amount of projects that are coming into Louisiana or existing companies that just feel like this is the right time to be expanding. And it's across a wide variety of sectors. You see data centers in North and South Louisiana. You see big LNG projects announcing over in the Lake Charles area. Just fascinating manufacturing projects, a drone manufacturer, you know, moving into Lafayette. It's kind of the talk of the town, and a big bioenergy project in Alexandria. It's just really fascinating how spread out across the state it is right now.
So, you know, we hear about New Orleans having a chance to bid for the Super Bowl after not having this, having that, the other thing. And it's like, okay, you got it. Good luck. How do you do it now? And I don't mean that sarcastically at all. I mean it sincerely. So when it comes to you pitching, or at least the state pitching itself among other against other states to get jobs, what are some of the things that Louisiana has? Tell you what, I just noticed the clock. You can tell them when we come back. Some of the things Louisiana has going for it, some of the things that Louisiana has to overcome. We're talking to Adam Knapp, CEO of Leaders for a Better Louisiana. Louisiana set a record, staying above the 2 million job mark for 7 months. How do you keep it going, and how do you build upon that? We'll continue the conversation. We come back. Adam Knapp, CEO of Leaders for a Better Louisiana. I'm Tommy Tucker. Time to go to Joe Cardosi for a look at traffic on WWL. 7:25, Tommy Tucker, WWL, having an interesting conversation with Adam Knapp, CEO of Leaders for a Better Louisiana. Louisiana set a record, staying above the 2 million job mark for 7 straight months. So along those lines, Adam, first of all, where are the new jobs going to come from? I know you mentioned some of the industries already, but looking ahead 5-10 years down the line?
So it's interesting because we're the sectors that seem to be expanding right now are heavily connected to the energy industry and kind of future of energy. Almost everywhere in the state, you're seeing activity that kind of touches energy industry. Data centers and kind of supply chain of some data centers. We saw two companies up in the kind of the northwest part of the state that expanded that were connected to data center supply chain. And then we had this really interesting series of projects in shipbuilding where you had this project down in Franklin that had kind of an autonomous shipbuilding project along with the steel industry, two or three different projects that are in the steel industry, kind of bringing new supply chain into the U.S. as there's a desire to have more local manufacturing in the U.S. of that product. So it's really been interesting, kind of the broad variety of companies that are and sectors that are represented in this space. And I think that's what you're seeing is the state pushing to look for not only its existing strength in energy, but new sectors coming in a wide variety of ways.
So what do leaders tell economic development leaders, tell companies that might be thinking about another state? What can they tell them that Louisiana has reasons for bring those industries, bring those jobs to Louisiana?
You know, I think there's a great example in Hyundai Steel in Donaldsonville that the state and the local leaders have been preparing the land to take to make it really investment ready. And I think the state's doing some smart things all over Louisiana to try to prepare more sites like that. And it sounds boring to say, hey, let's just get a good, really good site. But that's really critical. The state has been made a big investment last year, about $150 million into site preparation all over Louisiana. And that has proven to be really, really timely to get ready for projects and what they need. Second big thing is like energy supply is a huge thing. So a lot of what companies are looking for is to make sure they have a ready supply of low cost power. And so that still is a differentiator across the country, is that Louisiana is really advantaged in having very low cost power. It's not sexy necessarily, but it's helping us win a story. And the third thing is Louisiana made a huge change to its tax code last year. For states that have an income tax, corporate or personal, Louisiana has pushed to lower it to be among the lowest in the South. And that story thread of kind of low personal and corporate income taxes is starting to get out there and telling the story for what the state's got as an advantage.
You can have a philosophical argument if you like about tax credits, about site preparation, about this, that, the other thing. That's fine, but when it comes to the real world pragmatically, you're competing with other states that are willing to do this, and that's really where the discussion has to begin. Am I wrong?
No, you're 100% right. Virginia, Georgia, North Carolina, Ohio, states have been putting huge investments into sites, and Louisiana has recognized the need to compete, to put the same kinds of investments into site readiness. Into tax code changes. And to credit to the legislature and the administration for doing so in a fairly balanced way. We actually did a study last year to see if in changing the tax code, did it change kind of the fairness across all household income groups? And largely what the changes they've made have done is keep it fairly balanced, but they just redistributed kind of where the taxation occurs. And it looks like it more or less kind of helped the state compete without necessarily putting the burden on any single kind of household income group, which is what you hope to see in tax changes.
Is there a synergy that happens where once you get one, then before you know it, you got two and you got a snowball effect?
You do. Yeah, you're seeing that right now in data centers, is like the momentum for the state and having been able to prove that it works for one is really kind of starting to get the state's attention. But it's doing that across energy, across technology sectors. You're seeing that in New Orleans. It's really exciting.
Adam, next year I'm going to talk to you on January 14th, 2026. We'll be talking about 3 million jobs, all right?
Let's do it. I love it.
Thank you, sir. Have a good year.
You too.
Adam Knapp, CEO of Leaders for a Better Louisiana. We'll talk to DA Jason Williams about the new Lights On initiative, working with the Moreno administration on public safety when we come back right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 7:44, 16 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Jason Williams, New Orleans District Attorney. Good morning, Mr. District Attorney. How are you?
Good morning, Mr. Tucker. How are you?
Happy. Well, come on. I would be Mr. Radio Announcer. I wouldn't be Mr. How you doing? How's mom? How's everybody? Happy New Year to y'all.
My mother is doing really well. I'm just blessed to have another year with her, and family's good. Life is what we make it. We got a lot of work to do.
You got a good idea there, my friend. Tell me about streetlights and why the district attorney was concerned with the Lights On initiative.
You know, this sort of grows out of what we were talking about the last time I was with you, when we were talking about our No Dice initiative, which Chief Michael Harrison was a huge part of and Daniel Shanks directed. And both of those folks are now working with the new mayor. And one of the things that came out of the transition, when you talk to the mayor, you talk to Deputy Chief Harrison, was people saying they were living in the dark. They were walking through the dark when they were getting out of their car, going home, during the thoroughfares they were traveling in. And it's one of the main things that we always made sure happened at all of the sites of our No Dice initiative. We worked with the city department to get lights up for those blocks, so that after we working with the ATF and the LSP and the New Orleans Police Department, after we moved and made the arrest and were prosecuting the people that were committing crimes in the area, we made sure that they came back in and cleaned it up. The city cleaned it up, not the DA's office, and we made sure that it was lit up. And I think the mayor is doing exactly what she said she wanted to do, which was deliver the services people know they deserve, to all the parts of the community. And she started in a place that's been historically underserved as it relates to street lights and beautification. And I think it's going to be really important to getting that Willow's apartment back on the market, into commerce, and operating in a healthy, lawful way.
Tell me about, is it as simple as bad things happen in the dark? I know that sounds crazy, but I think that goes back to time immemorial, doesn't it?
I mean, yeah, you know, Tommy, some of the most important things we learned in kindergarten, some of the most important things we've known our whole lives, it's just the political will and the discipline to make sure that you do all of the basics well, right? We're asking and hoping that somebody will come in and purchase that building. Well, I mean, would you go purchase an apartment complex that that didn't have a single streetlight on and the grass wasn't mowed? So, I mean, the city's got to do its part. That's putting skin in the game, so the business sector sees it's worth putting skin in the game. So it is very basic, but it is very, very critical to making sure that we have a healthy community.
You're at the inauguration on Monday. Tell me about the feeling, not just in the city, but as far as you're concerned, from your opinion, about the feeling with those in government and involved with the government about the a new air, if you will, that's at City Hall and in New Orleans.
It was kind of electric, and I'm not trying, it's not hyperbolic. People from all walks of life, especially folks in public safety spaces and other elected officials, even those who were from different parties, felt like there was real, honest dialogue and conversation about what the plan was, about what the priorities were going to be. And that has carried over. It hasn't stopped. I've been very excited throughout all of the inaugural events. But the first couple of days, I mean, not only were we in New Orleans East with the Mayor's Lights On Initiative, at 1 o'clock, she convened a meeting with all of the public safety leaders in the region. That's the new U.S. Attorney David Corsell, FBI Special Agent Select, ATF Special Agent in Charge, LSP, Troop NOLA, NOPD, every single law enforcement entity, state, local, and federal, was in that room with this mayor and her deputy mayors talking about going into the next year, talking about lines of communication. And I didn't have a single meeting like that at all in the last term that was directed by the chief executive of the city. And everyone was really excited in that meeting, strategizing, talking about conversations that can be had in D.C., conversations that need to be had in Baton Rouge, and how we can best communicate with each other so that we're delivering excellence for the people of this community. So there's a lot of optimism.
Communications, as simple as it sounds, it's amazing how the lack of it can cause so much problem. We'll pick it up when we come back with Jason Williams. We'll continue to communicate with him, New Orleans District Attorney. You got any questions, comments, text him in the 504-260-1870. We come back, we're going to talk about NOLA Safe, a partnership with federal law enforcement that's underway right now. Time for WWL Traffic. 7:55, 5 till 8, Tommy Tucker talking to DA Jason Williams about Operation New Lights On Initiative by Mayor Helena Moreno, about the feeling in the city, about how things are looking up and a far more optimistic in communication and how important that is. Let's talk about NOLA Safe, Jason.
It's a phenomenal program. It's not a totally new concept. It's really just strategic collaboration between federal and state law enforcement entities. But it's got the FBI, it's got the ATF, it's got the DEA working with the NOPD on the municipal level and the LSP on the state level. But they're focused on the city of New Orleans, and they're using the National Guard strategically. You know, we've got a different relationship with the National Guard than some other cities. They've been coming here for many years for our large events. So people of New Orleans, visitors to New Orleans, don't have that same sort of shock and awe because we know the role that they can play for large events. But what this is going to do is create these strategic sort of pods or partnerships so that if a National Guardsman sees something, he or she can easily get that information and work with NOPD or ATF, who are all going to be on the scene to effectuate an investigation, make an arrest if need be. And then, you know, the important part is that evidence is collected and a report is written so that can get to me or the U.S. Attorney's Office so we can prosecute the case. So it's not just visibility in terms of public safety, but it's also setting up some real intelligence in terms of going after networks of bad offenders. It's only for a limited period of time through February, but it's going to lead to intelligence that will continue to drive other investigations for these agencies moving forward. And I think it's really special that we're using the National Guardsmen in probably the most strategic way compared to any of the other cities that have had them deployed. Whatever life throws you, you got to make it work. And I think that's what we're trying to do here in the city of New Orleans, because that's kind of our culture, you know, whether it's fighting hurricane season and having to go through a lot of things that a lot of other residents don't have to go through in this country. We're used to being nimble.
Yeah. You know, what intrigued me about this as I read the story about NOLA Safe is the prospect of federal charges as opposed to local, because that to me can be a game changer. Talk about that, if you will.
I mean, we can go back to the Ken Polite days, or we can talk about the Jim Lutton days or before. Having strong federal prosecutions in conjunction with what we're doing on the state level really changes the environment on the ground. There's a host of charges that we don't even have in our tool belt. Mm-hmm. And you've got jurors from all over, from a larger swath of the region who are going to be hearing these cases. And you're talking about a whole nother section of courts and judges that can be operating, handling cases at the same time. So it relieves that bottleneck. You don't have to be a lawyer to understand that if you're only got prosecutions happening at a robust level in the 12 courts of Tulane and Broad, only so many cases can be handled a day. Well, when that engine is turned on, and that's what David Corcell made it very clear he wants to do, he wants to start very quickly with upping the number of federal prosecutions. That's going to be a game changer in the city of New Orleans.
Yeah, because it's less, it's probably, I would think, maybe more experienced prosecutors, no disrespect to anybody in your office, but and it also frees up their time, right?
Facts are facts. More experienced prosecutors, more of them, and a whole lot more resources. You start talking about the FBI, the ATF, and the Department of Justice. That's a lot more money going into these cases.
I still want to see you in court one day. I hear you're quite the litigator. Let me know.
Got to get you on jury duty. How about that?
Well, I live in Plaquemines. That could be a problem, Jason.
Well, that could be a problem. They're not going to let me prosecute out there. They're not going to let you be on a jury.
Well,
over
no,
here.
But I can go to Orleans Parish and watch you prosecute a case. I can do that. I'd like to watch you in action.
We'll set it up.
Thank you, Jason.
I'd love to have you in
all
there.
All right, man. Have a good day. Jason Williams, New Orleans District Attorney. Have a great year. We'll talk to Ronald Serpas. I want to talk to him about the National Guard and more when we come back. 8:14 on this Wednesday morning, January 14th. Wednesday's the day at this time we generally take a deep dive into crime with former NOPD Superintendent Ronald Serpas, head of the Nashville State Police at one point, head of the Nashville City Police, Washington State Police, now a professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. If you watch TV during the day, he'll pop on occasionally as something happens on CNN or one of the major networks about as a consultant about stuff that's happening. How you doing, Chief?
Tommy, I'm great. How are you?
I'm okay. You know, I wanted to talk to you about, I was coming to work this morning about 4:30, coming down Camp Street by Julia, a little bit past Julia, heading toward the bridge, toward Calliope. That's how you say it, right?
Calliope.
No, bro, it's Calliope. Come on. And I noticed three National Guard officers walking, and they were the only ones out there. And I got to thinking about, well, let's see, Tommy, how do you feel about that? And I got to thinking about a couple of different things. First of all, they're not hurting anything, certainly. Then I got to thinking about how much it costs for them to be there. I got to thinking about how it is a presence if there would be somebody, a ne'er-do-well, it was up to no good. Then I got to thinking about the National Guard themselves being away from their families and at what price they were. I got a lot of different thoughts going through my mind at 4:30 in the morning as I saw these guys. At no point, it may have been a woman I didn't look at closely, at no point did it upset me or bother me. Tell me your thoughts on the National Guard and so forth.
Well, over these last 45 years, Tommy, every year, I was in the New Orleans Police Department. The National Guard had came out to help the city of New Orleans recover from hurricanes, present Mardi Gras, present Super Bowls, Final Four, Sugar Bowls. So essentially, the ugly, twisting head of politics has once again invaded something that's been used for decades to help make people safe. Mm-hmm. It's always in this conversation, Tommy, to me, it's just one political lens wants to see it in one way and have their persons believe them, and another one wants to see it in another way. But rest assured that the National Guard was called up for the RNC and the DNC conventions to help provide safety for the police officers to go do the more critical police functions. They do traffic stop. They do food service during major events and crises. It's actually, Tommy, there's nothing new here.
Mm-hmm. Well, the only reason I was wondering that the questions that popped into my mind are, okay, if they see something about to happen or happening, mm-hmm. what do they do? What's their role? And again, I don't mean as chief. Look, I don't mean this from a negative standpoint, because it didn't bother me at all. If anything, it was comforting that they were there. I just wonder about the costs and what's at what cost. Nothing's free, right? Does it happen? These people are taken away from their families, blah, 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 et cetera. Go ahead.
Absolutely. My response wasn't be contrary with you. My response is, police are often thrust in the middle of these raging political debates that often have little reality to what's on the ground. Think of COVID. COVID became a police problem because some political leadership wanted police to arrest people who weren't wearing masks. That made a public health problem a police problem. So to your question, I would bet without doubt in my mind that if three National Guard members were walking on any street in New Orleans in the middle of the night, that had been part of a plan coordinated with the New Orleans Police Department. And therefore, they would have likely very instant communication abilities to radio and say, hey, we see something suspicious here. Secondly, we know that police deterrence during any time, the visibility of a deterrent factor helps. Tommy, I've said this before, and I'm sure I'll be criticized. Criminals are cowards. The planning criminal who wants to create havoc is looking for signs of authority figures, is looking for signs of video cameras, is looking for signs of witnesses. They are cowards. They sneak around
to
in the middle of the day.
To avoid them, not to confront them, to avoid them, right?
Exactly. So they're looking. So there is a value, I think, to either a police officer in uniform or perhaps a guard member in uniform, perhaps a firefighter in uniform. In other words, anybody who represents authority, they're going to spot them and say, well, I'm going to go around a corner. Now, some would argue that's just playing whack-a-mole, which corner to be on. However, the point is what happened in your mind is exactly what you would want to happen, that you saw something that looked like some level of authority that made you at least look. That's good.
Three of them together, that's for their safety, I would presume, as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Police officers in those kind of circumstances will normally be walking in a group of two. At a minimum, Bourbon Street, you know, I walked on Bourbon Street in the early 80s, Tommy, and we were supposed to be paired up. Often we weren't. But you want to be at least two officers, or in this case, they make group in three as a part of their protocols.
Well, you're so big, you're your own mounted unit. Let's be honest about that. You're like 6'9", and, you know, whatever. So, no, but seriously, so that's why three of them. And to be clear, these are people that signed up for duty, that's part of the in exchange for the benefits that they receive, they could be called up, and that's what's happening here, correct?
I would think that's absolutely the case, and oftentimes during Mardi Gras, you know, I only did 25 of them, nine mm-hmm. as the chief or the deputy chief. Oftentimes we will have activated military reservist units who are military police, not for all the audience, not to perform police functions, but because they have a little bit of better understanding of how policing works. So common. We used to get them from the San Francisco Marine Detachment, and they were the greatest individuals we ever worked with. They did not want to be police. They were not police. But they had a different level of training being military police. See the distinction? If they weren't police.
You know what? Let me take a break here. Police. I want to pick it up right there when you come back, because that resonated with me. They are not police, and they don't want to be police. And I think it all goes to perception and you know, we see somebody in a National Guard uniform, and maybe somebody thinks one thing. That's not what the person in the National Guard uniform is thinking to begin with, and it seems to me we're just talking about having eyes on the ground and intelligence and surveillance just to prevent anything that's going on. And what really resonated was when you said part of a plan, you would presume, where you see anything looks suspicious, you call it in, and then from there it goes to NOPD and they take care of it. 821, more when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 826 now, talking to Ronald Surpass, our friend, professor, practice Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, now a consultant to numerous departments. I brought up the National Guard because I happened to see three National Guardsmen, guardspeople, I don't know what the gender was, of the people that were walking down Camp Street this morning early at about 4:30. They were the only people out there, but maybe that's because they were the only people out there. That's why there was nobody else out there. Chief, you mentioned something before the break that I thought was notable, and that's that they don't want to be the police. And people that think that you know, again, you talk about the political thought here, that this is this armed battalion coming in to take over. That's not what's going on in these people's mind, at least from your experience, right?
No, sir, not at all. When you meet with the Guard, there are young men and women who are dedicated to service. Their assignment is to assist the New Orleans Police Department and, more importantly, the city of New Orleans. See the distinction there? It's not just the police department. It's the city of New Orleans that says, yes, we need you during Mardi Gras, Super Bowl, Sugar Bowl, unexpected events, hurricanes, floods. That's when they do their best job. They come and they do what the police department asks them to do. And it's a valuable, valuable relationship for at least the 50 years almost I'm in this work.
I get texts from about this every time we talk about National Guard. Yeah, but the weapons aren't loaded. Again, just your thoughts on that, please.
I think there's a lot of misconceptions of what they actually do. And our friends in leadership on either side of the equation don't help the general public when they politicize what they want their answer to be versus just talk about the facts. I've always come to expect and believe, and I'm sure you do in your business, the public is a whole lot more attuned and aware of things than some would believe. So I think people really understand what's happening.
So what happens if they, for example, witness a carjacking or they see a carjacking happening? Are they empowered to intervene? Do they just call it in? What is the plan? Do you know?
It starts to dance on the head, the pinhead of a law, but any citizen can interrupt a crime to protect another citizen. That's just as old as we are as a nation. They cannot exercise a law enforcement authority. Now, the question of whether or not they can exercise a citizen authority takes a little bit of thinking through the circumstance, but generally it's going to be call the police right away, just like a citizen would. But Tommy, rest assured, if you were walking there this morning and you saw someone being assaulted at 4:30 in the morning and you decided to help, you could help and you would be legally fine helping to protect someone who can't protect themselves.
So it's not a disadvantage that they're wearing the uniform?
I don't think so. I think it's more of an advantage of visibility like we talked about at the beginning. And
I mean,
is a very powerful component.
As far as them wanting to help, to get involved in helping, they have their rights as a citizen even though they're wearing a uniform, right?
Yeah, it comes down to the technicality of enforcing law, but helping citizens is something we all have a right to do.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time as always. Ronald Surpass, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent. Saw a text this morning, Tommy, cab driver. Saw around 2 a.m. this morning, two National Guard members talked with the driver on 800 St. Louis Street and later NOPD and state troopers. So what is your thought about it? Are you seeing the National Guard walking around, and what are your thoughts on it? Because I really did get to thinking about it, about the different aspects and angles and so forth, and it didn't bother me. And again, if it's eyes and ears on the ground, what can it hurt, right? And I do think the chief is right. I don't think they come in thinking that they want to be the police. These are just guys and women that signed up for National Guard duty, as I understand it. In exchange for certain benefits and certain rights, or just to serve the country, and this is part of it. We'll take a break and back talk to Cokie Riley about LSU. He's the LSU beat writer for The Advocate. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 8:45, quarter till 9. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Cokie Riley, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. You can follow him on Twitter at Kokireley, which of course would be his name, and that's why that's his Twitter handle. How you doing, Cokie?
Doing pretty well. How's it going?
Pretty good. I'm seeing this tweet that I watched more tape of what I'd already seen from Sam Levitt, and then wrote a story about his game, and I didn't have a chance to watch the tweet, but I'd love to hear about it if you don't mind sharing some of it with us. What did you see about Sam Levitt?
Yeah, so with Levitt, you're looking at a very mobile quarterback who is very comfortable making plays off script, outside of the structure of the offense and the play that's sort of intended to be called. He likes to freelance quite a bit, so to say, and he can sort of pair that with a very strong arm, an NFL caliber arm, to say the least. And you kind of have those two attributes, and those are two pretty important attributes for a lane-given offense. Lane-given offenses are very structured, well-structured. They're very scripted. But Levitt kind of brings his own aspect to that offense to create a little bit more variability. And he has the arm strength to access throws to all sides of the field. And his accuracy can wane and wax a little bit on shorter throws, medium, intermediate throws. But I think mechanically he has everything you kind of need to be a little bit more consistent with that side of his game. It's more about, you know, cleaning up and polishing some things here and there. So I think overall, this is a quarterback who could be one of the best quarterbacks in the country next year. The biggest question mark, though, easily, is his foot injury and how that heals heading into next season.
Mm-hmm. But at Liz Frank, tell me what you know about Liz Frank injuries, just from athletes past that have had them.
Yeah, it's typically known as a pretty tricky injury, and it's one that needs to be taken care of very carefully in order for it to fully heal. And I'm having trouble coming up with an exact example.
An athlete, it's the kind of thing, Cokie, that has a frivolous name, but it's anything but frivolous. It's like something to do with the metatarsal in the foot. But if you don't get on this and treat it right from the beginning, it's the kind of thing that can bother you for the rest of your career. Am I right in that?
Exactly. Yeah, it is. It's just a very, very tricky injury, and it hasn't been 100% confirmed. That's the exact injury that Levitt got.
Okay.
But that's been the rumored, reported, whatever you want to call it. That's what it is. So if that's what it is, and that's my guess is what it is, then that's very, very tricky. And if that is the case, then he almost certainly won't be able to do anything in spring ball. That hasn't been fully ruled out yet, but it's pretty important for like a new quarterback with all new receivers that he's working with at a new place to get some work in during the spring. And now it doesn't really seem like that's going to happen.
That was my next question to you. If it doesn't happen, does it change anything when LSU starts their season?
It's going to mean more work for Landon Clark and whoever the other scholarship quarterback they get is, which actually might not be a terrible thing for LSU, and just seeing what they got in Clark or seeing what they got in whoever the other quarterback they get is, whether that's Ryan Staub, a Colorado transfer who may be visiting pretty soon, or Hussein Longstreet, who came onto campus just before they got Levitt's commitment and is a former five-star recruit. So I guess that's the only real benefit of it. But you'd still much rather have your star quarterback that you're paying millions of dollars for to get his reps in within the new offense and with the new receivers that he's working with. I think like building that chemistry, understanding the system on the field in real time, those are kind of invaluable reps. And given the pressures that will be on LSU heading into next season, given the amount of money that they're spending on everything, the coaching staff, the players, all of it, I feel like that's very, very important.
The reason I asked that is when you said freelance, my eyebrow went up a little bit, because that can be a good thing, that can be a bad thing. Then you said very structured offense with Lane Kiffin. Does he keep that freelancing under control, and will that freelancing ability maybe help him if he does miss spring? Well, he is going to miss spring practice.
Yeah, so, like, in every offense, I don't want to confuse people too much when I say that, because in every offense, there's a play in the huddle, right? And sometimes that play is changed at the line of scrimmage, depending on what the defense is doing. And as the play unravels, sometimes your first and second option isn't open, And sometimes you just kind of need to scramble out of the pocket and do something, right? You've seen Patrick Mahomes do this. You'll see Josh Allen do it all the time. Like Lamar Jackson is kind of famous for this. A lot of the best quarterbacks in the NFL, a lot of the best quarterbacks in college football can kind of make these plays that look like they're totally off script. And a lot of that has to do with you have to be mobile in order to do it. And you have to be able to be willing to make plays off platform where you're throwing the ball with your body contorted in all these different ways and you're throwing on the run and like you're making a very athletic, instinctual sort of play. And that is one of Levitt's great strengths, is that he can extend a play with his legs, he can scramble for extra yards, he can make throws on the run, on the move, to really all parts of the field because of his arm strength. And that's definitely a strength in this game. Sometimes he can get a little bit too wild or get a little bit too aggressive in throwing a ball into a window that isn't really there. But for the most part, I think that's a good thing, especially when you're in an offense like the Lane Kiffin offense. That's when I say it's very structured and very well structured. It means that, you know, there's a lot of, you can get to a lot of options pretty easily and pretty simply, as we saw with Trinidad Chambliss this year, where it just felt like they could get 5 yards or 10 yards anytime they wanted to. And sometimes if you're facing a really great defense, they do a good job of sort of shutting that stuff down. So if you have a quarterback who can sort of create out of structure, off script a little bit, it adds another element to that offense. You kind of see that with the Niners. Like the Niners have a really well-constructed offense, but they have a quarterback who can sort of make plays out of nothing in Brock Purdy, and that's sort of helped their attacks if he's been the starting quarterback.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Sounds like he has a plan after he gets punched in the mouth, to paraphrase Mike Tyson. 852 traffic now, WWL. 858, 2 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Back with Cokie Riley, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. Let's talk about the rest of the roster, transfer portal, how it's looking, running backs, et cetera. Cokie?
Yeah, I mean, running back, just to sort of summarize and start, bringing back Caden Durham, who entered the transfer portal, is pretty big. It means you're bringing back your top two rushers from last season. I think the expectation heading into the portal season was that you're probably going to lose one of those guys, and Frank Wilson was going to return, and Frank Wilson didn't return with Ole Miss. So I think when you got that, you have your top two backs, and then they've been able to fill out the room with some other guys, Rod Ganey, Racine Guillory, Dylan Jones from Wisconsin. Those three guys are going to be put in as depth pieces and good pieces to the system that they have. Offensive line has been kind of the biggest question mark, though, when it comes to really the whole roster, because the rest of this team is close to being filled out, close to being finished. They've added 9 receivers from the transfer portal. They've plugged in some holes on the defensive side of the ball. But the offensive line is really the question mark right now, because, I mean, they got to replace 4 starters potentially. They'll have 2 guys coming back. They lost a lot of the depth that they once had as well. They've added 3 offensive linemen from the portal, but that's not going to be enough. They're going to have to add another 2, 3, 4, potentially even more.
Thank you, Cokie.
Guys from the portal.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. And into the 9 o'clock hour we go, 9:07 now. Phil Napoli joins us, our friend, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media and the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Happy New Year. Tell me about the book before we get started here.
Sure. So the book explores how our social media ecosystem has sort of exacerbated disinformation problems and what, if any, regulatory solutions we could apply within the context primarily of the U.S. and this obviously the strong First Amendment tradition that we have here.
So let's talk about what happened in the Senate with the I don't even know what the name of the bill is, but it's about deep fake pornography. Explain what that is in family-friendly terms, if we can, what that is and what the Senate bill would do.
Sure. So deep fake pornography is using AI image generation to generate pornographic images. And, you know, the key part of this that's hugely important, of course, is that this is, you know, non-consensual generation of images, and that, that can be, violations of privacy, violations of human dignity, on and on. And unfortunately and increasingly, we're seeing it used to generate child pornography. So we have something already that that has passed called the Take It Down Act. And the Take It Down Act actually doesn't come into effect until May fully, but it criminalizes what you call non-consensual intimate imagery. So criminalizes the production and dissemination of things like deep fake pornography.
Are we starting with anything real here at all, or is the whole thing artificial?
You don't need to start with anything real in the sense that the AI image generators have already hoovered up all the necessary real photos. So,
let me phrase it this way, Professor. I don't mean to interrupt you. Let me phrase it this way, and I'm trying to think of a way to present this. Let's say I want to have a picture of somebody's arm with a tattoo on it. Let's make that the analogy, okay? I want somebody, I want to have a deep fake of my arm. Somebody wants to do a deep fake of my arm with a tattoo of an anchor on it. That's about as family friendly as we can be, right? Does there have to be a real arm to begin with? Does there have to be a real tattoo to begin with? Or can all of this be created out of a series of zeros and ones to create an arm and then create the tattoo, and then all of a sudden they put it on my body?
More or less, yes. And because the AI image generator has plenty of arms and plenty of tattoos to draw from. Could someone say, well, is that definitely Tommy's arm? But there's enough raw materials there that, they don't need a picture of you and your arm, et cetera. In other words, the creator of the image doesn't need that. The AI system has typically everything that it needs.
And it could be an amalgam of different arms, correct?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And again, what they've got archived at this point to use as raw materials is practically limitless.
All right. So you can have a law, but enforcement is something else entirely. So let's go back to my example of, I don't like the idea that there is a deep fake out there of my arm with a tattoo of an anchor on my body. How do I go about, who would I call? Who do I call? It's like I see them, it's like, I'm outraged. Who do I call? What do I do?
Well, I mean, what you've just described, I think you're totally out of luck, because it wouldn't rise to the level of a non-consensual intimate image. So you with a tattoo, especially as a public figure, you're out of luck. It would have to be something worse than that for you to have any.
Well, but let's presume, and again,
recourse.
That's why I cleaned it up to that. Let's presume that it's the worst thing possible, but under the auspices of a tattoo on an arm, okay?
Right. If it's worse than that, then yes, the Take It Down Act gives you the right to reach out to the platform where it is circulating, and they have 48 hours to take it down. Under the new legislation that's also being considered in the Senate, it would give you rights to sue. If that is not handled,
I guess what I'm wondering. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was saying, so there are efforts in place to empower you as the victim more than you currently are empowered.
But I guess what I'm wondering is, all of this just feel good stuff, or is there anything that can actually be done? Because for example, and this is a true story, I've been trying to cancel DuckDuckGo for like 5 months now. I don't know how to do it. I can't get through. I don't know what to do. I just can't. I keep going to here, to there, circular, circular, circular. And if I can't get that done, what hopes do I have of reaching the platform, first of all, determining, okay, so this would be on a platform, say, give me a platform that this would appear on, some type of deep web thing,
or just float around on X.
On X, okay, or float around on X until I guess they would at some point take it down?
If you asked.
If I asked.
Yes. But here's the thing. I mean, as these sort of pieces of legislation pass, I mean, the reality of this is that any one of these services that generates these deep fakes, it is not difficult for them to disable this functionality. That's reality. Because some, I don't know, if you ask ChatGPT to do this sort of thing, it won't. It is no surprise that the biggest problem where we're seeing this right now is with Grok, with Elon Musk's AI bot.
All right, let's go slow here. Let's go through that. What problems are we seeing with Grok?
So the latest problems with Grok is that it is being used to generate again, non-consensual sexualized images of folks, of kids as well. The poor, the girl from Stranger Things who's 14 years old, apparently there are, images of her floating around that Grok has generated. So he's, now that is the focus of a lot of regulatory attention, in the UK, for example. Some countries have actually banned Grok at the moment because of its ability to be used in this way. So the reason I bring this up is because the service, it's very easy for them not to provide this kind of functionality. And it almost is silly, I think, to sort of direct the enforcement at the end user or the distributor when these these services could very easily disable this functionality, whether voluntarily or by regulation or by threat of massive numbers of lawsuits or by the death of their business model. There's all sorts of pressures that can be applied here.
But here's what I'm trying to understand. In this case, they're owned by the same guy, right?
Grok? Absolutely. So when you have owner of the AI bot and the owner of the social media platform, not only do you have the mechanism for creation, but distribution is built right in there as well.
So I guess I'm just trying to follow this through. I always try to look at things, Professor, from a real person standpoint, okay? So First of all, whoever this, what was the name of the show you said?
Stranger Things.
Okay. So first of all, whatever it is that's floating around, and I don't think we need to get into the specifics of it, but whatever is floating around might not even be a real human body part. It could be an amalgam of different body parts from God knows how many different people. Accurate?
Accurate.
Okay. So she would take exception because that's her face that's on it, yes?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
But really, when you get right down to it, and I'm trying to be delicate about this, what are people seeing? Because they're not really seeing her, right?
Right.
But, now, I understand if it's your daughter, if it's your daughter, you're going to feel differently about it. I get that. But all this is, when you get right down to it, is this is the same as somebody. You know how they make these signs with a big face on it, somebody's face on it? This is a high-tech version of somebody appearing in public, say at a Mardi Gras parade, naked, holding up a mask with this person's face on it. Accurate or not?
Yes, except it's obvious to anybody
that's
the artifice
fake.
There.
Right.
Yeah. To me, there's a better analogy. This is the high-tech version of what we've seen, for years and years, which is, using Photoshop to, copy and paste somebody's head, right, onto a nude model. But that's very easily detectable as well. This gets very, very difficult to detect.
All right, let's take a break here and try to digest what we've heard, because again, going back to my experience with trying to cancel a server, a search engine service, I just don't know how you would even begin to. And I understand the legislation and the necessity for it, but I just don't know how in practice any of this could ever work, and how, if you take it down here, it's like whack-a-mole, it's going to come up somewhere else. We're talking about Phil Napoli, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media in the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age, Elon Musk's Grok, drawing scrutiny around the world for generating sexually explicit deepfakes. Some countries are blocking it entirely. What kind of regulation do we have in the United States around this, and how much moderation do social media companies do? Are they humans making these decisions, or is all of that automated? Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us. Back in a flash, WWL. It is 9:25. Not so fun when we talk about Grok and deepfake, explicit, sexually explicit deepfakes involving child porn in some cases. Phil Napoli, our guest, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media in the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. So let me talk about Grok here. Who has access to Grok? And I'm trying to look at this from the enforcement angle of it. If somebody makes a deep fake of my kid, and I don't a child, and I don't like it. My kid's 29, so you know it still would bother me. But a child, and it's child pornography, and how do you go about backtracking that? Who creates this? How do they get it on Grok? Who approves it? Does somebody approve this before it gets posted, or is anybody approving anything before it gets posted, or is it the Wild West? And then only if somebody complains does then somebody start doing something to take it down?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a little complicated with Grok. So, for example, there's a version of Grok that is just on X, right, that's embedded into the social media platform. So you could literally go on X and see what people are asking Grok to do. And then it's right there on X to be shared. It also exists as a freestanding app so that you can generate images and then, you know, distribute them if you choose to or don't choose to, but you know, or however you might see fit to distribute them. And so you know, there's a variety of ways you could use it. But when you ask it to do something, it has, in theory, built-in rules about what it won't do, just like all of these AI generators have. But it's certainly never any human weighing in, evaluating the appropriateness of your request as you make it.
So is it a human that's evaluating that? That's what I'm trying to understand. Or
No, not at all.
It's the machine that's evaluating that.
Yes, the machine has been given a set of rules about what it is and is not allowed to do. And so with the example with Grok, its rules about what it is not allowed to do are a lot looser than a lot of the other AI image generators.
Does artificial intelligence factor in any of this at all?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, that's fundamentally what's generating the image. That's what's processing the request and determining its appropriateness. My understanding, I don't know the specifics at all, but apparently some folks are getting good at phrasing the requests in such a way as to work around what the AI generator has been instructed not to do. Which seems like an odd skill, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to talk an AI image generator into doing something it's prohibited from doing, but these are the kind of skills people are developing.
At least it proves that the humans are smarter than the AI, at least for now, I guess.
Yeah, I guess we'll look at the bright side there.
So I'm looking at a story from the BBC here, and it quotes somebody from the Internet Watch Foundation. We do not believe it's good enough to simply limit access to a tool which should never have had the capacity to create the kind of imagery we've seen in recent days. Charity previously saying its analysts have discovered criminal imagery of girls aged between 11 and 13, which appear to have been created using Grok. So in this instance, and I know you don't know about this specific case, but would this have started with real child porn, or would this all be, or could this all be made up stuff, amalgams of different things, and somehow altered to look like, you know, I got to be careful what I say here because it can get dicey, but to physically look as though it's a child and not an adult, if it is a real picture, or can somebody take one of these iPads, you know, like an artist uses and draws things, and then from there generate that into an AI image?
I don't know about that. What that specific example you just gave, but again, yeah, no, the AI image generator does not need to have a library of child pornography to draw upon in order to generate a convincing image, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It doesn't need that as, you know, in its archives. But the other thing is with that BBC example, what they were referencing there about access is one of the things Musk did with Grok was started to put the AI image generation capacity behind a paywall. So it just becomes, that it was, you can still do it, but now it's behind a paywall, which seems silly.
Yeah. What's the word I'm thinking of? Certainly not sincere. Let's put it that way. A sincere effort to moderate this.
As a way to use it as a revenue generator.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. This is terrible. This is horrible. However, I'm making God knows how much money off of it. So it would seem as though if people wanted to get control of this, they would have to somehow, the good would have to overcome the bad, and the good would have to somehow make those that are profiting from this suffer so that they would improve their behavior?
Exactly right. And that can come from a variety of directions.
Well, let me just say what I'm thinking. Yeah. If for whatever reason you're so incensed at this with Grok, if you were to start a protest and stop using X, stop buying Teslas, stop doing whatever it is that Elon Musk makes money doing, well, then maybe you'd get his attention. Accurate or not?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And if people did that in mass and importantly stopped buying the products for anybody who advertises on X, that has to be a key part of this as well.
I got you. And is there any sincere attempt to do that? Or are people... See, because first of all, before people can do that, they'd have to understand what is going on and how prevalent is it, and how many people realize the degree of prevalence? Let me ask it that way.
That's a good question, and it's, I don't know the answer to that. One always wonders how much this stuff sort of is percolating outside of, you know, the realm of those of us who do this kind of thing for a living.
And this is Grok. This is like one of the things that's out there, right? I mean, that's a lot of people know about and X and everything else. God only knows what's going on websites that are not, I hate to say, or apps that aren't as reputable as that, correct? Or social media platforms that aren't as reputable, and I put reputable in quotation marks, as that.
Yeah, I mean, and Grok is, I mean, and X is pretty way down the list at this point as far as being reputable. Okay. And its user base has shrunk.
Popular maybe would have been a better word.
Base has shrunk.
Maybe popular would have been a better word. Okay.
Yeah, but even there, he has diminished it since he's bought it. He has diminished its reach. He has diminished its advertising revenue. All of those things.
So, where do we go from here? Because I don't see this getting better anytime soon. I know we passed a law in the Senate. It's not gotten through Congress. I don't know if the House is going to look at it or not. But even at that, it seems like it's going to be God knows how many layers removed from it actually appearing on the Internet. Again, to who do you call and how do you get it taken down, or what legal course do you pursue? There's no way to streamline any of this, is there? I guess what I'm trying to say, Phil, is that if, God forbid, there's a fake out there of your child that appears to be engaging in some kind of terrible act with God knows what, and you want it taken down, again, who do you call? What do you do? There was a time back 30 years ago, 20 years ago, my kid's email, I think it was a Twitter account and something else got hacked, and I was ready to pull a plug on everything and sit at the door with a shotgun. That's how I felt. Because I didn't know who to call or what to do. And I can imagine a parent going through that with their child with something like this on the Internet. What do you do? Because nothing's going to take it down quickly, right?
Well, according to the Take It Down Act, you should be able to reach out to the platform directly
and the platform should take it down within 48 hours. And if that doesn't happen, it is the Federal Trade Commission then where you would file a complaint, and they're in charge of enforcing that.
No, wait, now right there.
What's happening next?
Right there. Yeah. We call the FTC and we file a complaint, right?
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
And during, cannot emphasize this enough, even during that first 48 hours, and if it doesn't, you know, however long this drags on, this image could continue to circulate. People could download it and possess it on their own hard drives and recirculate it at some point in the future. And this really goes back to what I was saying before, which is unless all of the applications that generate AI images have this kind of functionality completely disabled, then yes, you are going to find enforcement of this difficult.
Could the United States ban, if for whatever reason this there was the wherewithal, the willpower to do this, could they just ban X in the United States and say, clean it up, or we don't want any part of it here, geofence it, however you do that?
I mean, again, some countries have done that. We have talked in the past about banning platforms like TikTok. Would the First Amendment challenge be, fairly strong? Yes, but we traditionally have not really had strong First Amendment protections for pornography, particularly for child pornography. And if a platform is a documented mechanism for producing and generating child pornography, you would like to think that if such a ban were to happen, that it would be upheld.
Any final thoughts, Phil?
No, I think you freaked me out more now.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. No, because let me tell you, because I don't look at it from the professor's standpoint. I look at it from that horrible day 20 years ago when all three accounts were. It was Facebook, maybe cell phone and some. I forgot what three it was. It was like all at one time, email or something else, all was hacked. And I was freaking out, man. I was getting ready to throw everything, all the computers in the water, and like I said, sit at the door with a shotgun and wait for the attack, the invasion. I look at it from the user end, and I guess you look at it from the other end. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
Safe travels. You got it. Phil Napoli, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media in the Public Interest, Media Regulation in a Disinformation Age. I wish I could tell you this is going to get better before it gets worse, but it's not. 9:37, we'll talk about the Pelicans when we come back. Talk about not getting better, but it's going to get worse. 9:37, 23 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:46, 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Ollie Cosell, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. How you doing, Ollie?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm all right. Happy New Year to you. How them Pels doing?
They're not rolling very well, are they?
No.
It's ugly. They're worse than the Western Conference.
That's pretty bad. Why?
A lot of reasons, really. And I could probably spend half an hour just talking about the single question. But
Let's get into them. I want to know.
In essence, the number one thing is they are in a process of development. When you draft two rookies that are such high lottery picks, you have to play them. There's always a mandate to play these guys because you invested so much in them already. And when you play the rookies, naturally they're not ready for the NBA. So defensively, teams have been taking advantage of them. And for instance, this month, the two of them going in the last night's game for the month of January were averaging a combined 7.5 turnovers. So there's just a lot of mistakes in essence they've got to play through. Some other things, of course, it's an incomplete roster. They did not have a real center to start the year. What I mean by that is somebody they could rely on, right, for 25, 30 minutes. Eve Missy, he shows promise. Same thing with Carlo Matkovich and, of course, Derek Queen. But, again, you've got to let these guys play through a lot of mistakes in order to let them grow so that they can become what you envision. So that's yet another problem.
Like what kind of mistakes, Ollie? Let me jump in here for a second. Like what kind of mistakes?
So when you're watching a game, you'll notice that Eve Missy, incredible athleticism. He can jump up and grab an offensive rebound amongst the best. But you also notice that, for instance, a simple pick and roll, he'll run with whether it's a Jordan Poole, Zion Williamson. He won't roll to the rim when he should. So that, in essence, makes the offense kind of clogs it up defensively. He doesn't know when to, again, he's on the ball. There's a screen set on his man. he should be able to understand the situation when he needs to jump out because it's a shooter, or stay back because it's not. It's those type of things that he's still having problems with doing it consistently. Mm-hmm. So when you screw that up against NBA competition that is so elite, that's going to show in the bottom line, in the bottom score.
Excellent explanation. Keep going, please.
Yeah, and the third thing I was going to say, Tommy, they just don't have enough shooting, right? I mean, you've noticed when Trey Murphy's not on the floor, and part of the problem is Jordan Poole has not been what they envisioned at all, right? They're missing C.J. McCollum because he was a consistent player, albeit with his faults. With Jordan Poole, younger guy, you expected to get somebody that's probably going to be a little more productive, but until this month, he couldn't make a three-point shot. And now when he is out there, he's making a lot of errors, right? Whether it's a lot of turnovers, again, making bad reads, bad passes, defensively, not giving you the effort you need. That's why his minutes have been so up and down since he's returned from injury. And then if you look down the bench, Jordan Hawkins, until last night's game, he hadn't hit a three-pointer for the entire month of January. So just a lot of underperformances. Combine that, like I said, with the holes and the rookie growing pains, that's how you get to 9-33.
Let's talk about Herb Jones and the defense.
Yeah, they miss him. They miss him dearly. And when he's been out there, they've actually been a decent team. That's when they went on that five-game winning streak. He was out there for all of those games. For some reason, they can't hold down the fort when he's not out there. So they know, for instance, they should be talking more, right, with one another, when to switch, when to do this and that. But yet they don't do it because they're used to Herb doing it, right? So he's just one of the best defenders in the league. And when you go up against any team, they're going to have two good scores. And you saw it last night. Jamal Murray went for 30 points. Peyton Watson, who's not really known as a good primetime scorer, went for 32 because you just don't have a stopper right now like Herb.
Tell me about the Brooklyn Nets.
Well, they're a young team that already beat up on the Pelicans when they went out to Brooklyn. They're going to need to get a little payback. But look, they're a team that is clearly one of the worst teams in the league. But what you saw when you played them last time, they played harder than the Pelicans, right? They ran up and down the court faster. They've got a decent young star in Michael Porter Jr. So they're a team, again, look, the Pelicans, they have to play their best to beat almost any team on any given night. And they're going to have to do that against Brooklyn, who plays faster, young, fresh legs, who are trying to prove themselves in this league.
Looking down the line, do you see anything substantive changing with this team?
You know, I don't expect any seismic changes on, the trade market. James Borrego's here to stay. Probably the biggest thing you could see is a couple role players getting moved because a contender needs to fill up, shore up their bench. Right? So whether that's a Kevon Looney, and I'm afraid maybe even a Jose Alvarado. They would like to keep Sadiq Bey, but I know there's a lot of value about him. But they've already come out several times saying they're not trading the rookies, of course, but also Herb, Trey, and even Zion Williamson's a part of that group right now.
How's he been looking?
He's been looking better in terms of his health, right, being able to play 30 minutes. But what's hurting, and you've noticed in the last two games, right, the Pelicans need to have somebody that could close for you, right? It's close game, whether they're up a point, down a point. That's when the stars in the league kind of take over games, take you to that finish line. And so far, Zion's not been able to do that, right? He just can't score because the biggest problem is he hasn't expanded his game, Tommy. He needs to get to the rim in order to be very effective. And obviously, teams know his recipe, so they're going to clog that middle up, won't allow him to get in there. So in essence, he's just got to expand his game, in my view. I mean, 7 years in the league, and we really haven't seen him improve on something dramatically in his game.
What do we know about DeJounte Murray coming back from his injury?
Yeah, if you asked me a month ago, it really felt like we were going to see him sometime towards the end of January, right before the All-Star break. Now it's kind of a question mark. And I'm wondering if the Pelicans are kind of going to bring him back along more slowly because there's no reason to rush him back. Two, you don't have a trade market for him. And three, you reinserted Jeremiah Fears into the starting lineup, right? That's your future. So I think in order to avoid that kind of a mess and a headache, we may not see him for a lot longer than we initially thought.
Any final thoughts, Ali?
No. I mean, we're just hoping for a second half where you see the young guys, right, grow up, that Zion Williamson starts developing some more confidence in his game and can become a closer. And, of course, having Herb stay healthier, Right? It's amazing what a difference this team in this team's performance is when he's out there and when he's not.
I know they lost to the Nets without Zion on December 14th, I think it was. You think they win tonight? Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they will. They've been playing better at home, and they've been playing better overall, right? A little bit more competitive, right? I mean, the last two games were good opponents, and they just couldn't close the deal in the fourth quarter. Brooklyn doesn't have really that type of – presents that type of problem.
All right, thank you, Ali Cosell, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. WWL, of course, your home for the Pelicans tonight. Pels taking on the Brooklyn Nets in the Smoothie King Center, pregame 6:30, tip-off at 7 on the Big 870 WWL AM. Head on out there, rather, and support the Pels. We'll be back, find out what Newell's got planned today on WWL.